Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on the Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast, listen at your leisure later, maybe even share them around. Who knows? Got Julian Pauly alive in the studio as usual. We'll be talking to RPG later in the show for his update this week. I think he says he's talking about all sorts of bits and pieces, but we've got a great piece of music for him, indeed. Also, our guest speaker this week is Phil Muffett from Mexborough and Swinton Astronomical Society. He'll be doing his Eye on the Sky slot. Bit of a change to normal, because next week it will be Chris Dale doing Obesity, and they've swapped round to make life easier. And also the clocks change next weekend as well, don't forget. But it's interesting about Obesity, because in the news this very week, I saw something that said millions of people will be summoned for annual weigh-ins at their GP surgery under new NHS guidelines to tackle obesity. All interesting stuff.
Yes.
Before I talk about when cakes meet chemistry, Paul's going to be talking about,
Yes, it was World Kidney Day on 13th of March. Did you know your kidneys help control blood pressure, keep bones healthy and help make red blood cells? Being active, reducing salt intake and drinking plenty of water can help keep yours in check. The truth about magnesium. This essential nutrient is linked to lots of health benefits, from easing anxiety to aiding sleep. Pumpkin seeds, chia seeds and spinach are magnesium-rich foods, so add some to your meals to up your intake.
All interesting stuff. So what's all this? When cakes meet chemistry. I thought it was a great article I saw in the press the other week, actually. So if you are a Great British Bake Off fan, you may know the name Josh Smalley, or Dr. Josh Smalley. He was a finalist in the TV competition in 2023, but he hasn't taken the customary post-show path. Instead, he runs an unusual cafe at the centre of the University of Leicester campus. So Dr. Josh Smalley is a postdoctoral researcher in chemistry, converted an old student hangout into a hub where he demonstrates his baking expertise and his knowledge of science. He teaches the principles of chemistry through cooking displays and shows how scientific laws underpin the creation of dishes. One of his lectures examines focaccia, in which enzymes break down complex sugars in the dough and drive the fermentation that creates the pockets of gas that give the bread its crated appearance. During the demonstration, sensors in the bread monitor the production of carbon dioxide. He says it's a great way to visualise what is going on. There are all sorts of ways that science affects cooking, he says. Take blueberry muffins. The sponge will come out red or pink if it is slightly acidic to begin with, but ends up more bluey-green if it's alkaline. Who knew, eh? So Dr. Josh Morley has taken his shows to the Cheltenham Science Festival and the Royal Institution in London. An April performance at the Edinburgh Science Festival promises a demonstration of Easter food, including, presumably, the chemistry of the hot cross bun. Who knows? Cracking track, that. Small Faces with Song of a Baker. Because we're talking about when cakes meet chemistry. Of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We are Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. Before we do our environment update, I just want to remind folks that the Sheffield Photographic Society have their annual exhibition at Sheffield Cathedral. It starts this Friday, 28th of March, and it runs until Sunday, the 6th of April. Check it out. So, environment update. France has unveiled a national climate adaptation plan to prepare the country for a potential 4 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of this century. The plan focuses on four priority areas: coastlines, mountains, forests and agriculture, with dozens of measures designed to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change and protect citizens, while also aiming to reach net zero by 2050. Most studies show that the world is on track for between 1.9 and 3.7 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of this century. Now then, according to scientists from the RSPB and Cambridge University, solar farms can host up to three times as many birds as farmland. Writing in The Conversation, the researchers say that a survey of solar farms in East Anglia showed that mixed habitat solar farms, where infrequent cutting or grazing allows wildflowers, trees and hedgerows to grow, were twice as abundant in bird life as intensively managed sites and three times higher than intensively farmed land.
Meanwhile, the government has pledged to work with the United Utilities Water Company, local authorities in Cumbria and environmental groups to eliminate all discharges into Lake Windermere, ensuring that only rainwater enters England's largest lake. Currently, treated wastewater and untreated sewage is at times discharged into lake, and scientists say it has contributed to algal blooming where the water turns green. In 2024, it was revealed United Utilities had repeatedly discharged millions of litres of raw sewage illegally into Lake over a three-year period.
Yeah, not good. Elsewhere in the news, a group of deaf scientists and educators have developed a new set of British Sign Language signs to make environmental science more accessible for the deaf community. A total of 400 signs, including terms such as deforestation, rewilding and greenhouse gases, have been created by the project at the University of Edinburgh's Scottish Sensory Centre.
A record number of grey seals have been counted at a nature reserve in Cumbria. Between September 2024 and March 2025, Cumbria Wildlife Trust recorded 563 seals at the South Walney Nature Reserve, up from the previous record of 518 set in 2021. Since becoming the first British mammal to be granted protected status, grey seal numbers in the UK have grown from only 500 in the early 20th century to more than 120,000.
Wow. Meanwhile, Cleethorpes Wildlife Rescue is not accepting seagulls with unknown illnesses into its care after a sudden increase in birds displaying concerning symptoms. The rescue centre is instead directing any cases of ill seagulls to the RSPCA in order to avoid an avian flu outbreak, which would lead to all birds at the Cleethorpes Wildlife Rescue Centre potentially being culled. Lincolnshire is currently part of one of the government's mandatory housing avian influenza prevention zones, where birds must be where bird keepers must house their flocks to protect them from an outbreak. Cleethorpes Wildlife Rescue said it was assessing each seabird prior to arrival.
Wow, would you know that?
No.
A Swedish energy company is researching ways to create high-performance skis using decommissioned wind turbine blades. Vattenfall has teamed up with EVI Ski, a Norwegian manufacturer, to trial alpine skis, carving skis and race skis using the material as part of its goal to recycle 100% of its end-of-life turbines by 2030.
I thought that was a fascinating thing. Yeah, aren't people inventive and creative? Finally, people experience less pain while viewing nature compared with urban or indoor environments. And that's according to researchers from the University of Exeter and the University of Vienna. The authors of the study, listen to this, it did make me think, oh my word, I'm not sure I would have volunteered for this. The authors of the study, which involved participants receiving electric shocks while viewing videos of different scenes, said that the findings highlighted the importance of protecting nature and would lead to more research on that, how it impacts mental health.
They've even loved her with other men. They've also drank a lot of wine. Some men have even had a good time.
What another interesting track. My Life is Natural by Slades.
Wow.
1971, I think that was a B-side to Because I Love You or something. May have been. Don't quote me on that. That's just off the top of my head. Of course, this is the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital at Fiend South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week, Saturday, 11 till 12. We should have RPG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, there's a whole sort of smorgasbord.
Oh, I say.
But starting off with a bit of a conflicting interest, I guess. News that the UK is to plant its first new national forest for quite some time, and 20 million trees are going to be planted in 2,500 hectares of new woodland created in the west of England. So down around Bristol and that sort of area, they're going to plant these trees over a time. The Western Forest, as it will be called, is made up of new and existing woodlands, and it crosses over Gloucestershire, Wiltshire, Somerset, the Cotswolds and the Mendips, as well as into urban areas like Bristol, Swindon and Gloucester. So it's the target England set of achieving 16.5% woodland cover in England by 2050, and with only 10% of that achieved so far, environmental groups have warned much more needs to be done in tree planting targets. But that's underway, and then the sort of other side of that coin is way across in the Amazon. And the Amazon is one of the areas that we rely on for carbon capture. And in preparation for the COP30 that's going to happen in Brazil, they're constructing a new four-lane highway which cuts through tens of thousands of acres of protected Amazon rainforest.
Yes, I saw that.
So it's set because they're going to host more than 50,000 people for the COP conference in November. But it's driven through areas where people were collecting wild berries for a living, lots of other things. There's a lot of logs piled up on land that's cleared. There are injuries to sort of animals because of the upset going through. So, what a world. What a conflict.
Indeed.
So, I just thought it was a bit of a wooden theme, but it's worth talking about. And
If I'd have known that, Paul, and you'd have talked about that at the end, I might have played Up the Wooden Hills to Bedfordshire.
Yes.
But I think that's Small Faces as well.
It is. Yeah, well, they actually did some great stuff.
They did.
Yeah. One of the things that if you do cooking and you use an old-fashioned electric hob, one of the problems if you were used to the old gas cookers is controlling the temperatures to slow cook things on the hobs. It's not as simple as it used to be. So sort of bemoaning the good old days, and then I read this article which says that the pollution from gas hobs is worse than that from a busy road. So, cooking on gas hobs can create a higher level of indoor air pollution than that found on one of UK's busiest roads. So, it's something that the witch watchdog has found. The levels of nitrogen dioxide is a significant contributor to children developing asthma, and fine particulate matter, PM2.5, both spiked on air quality monitors used in the tests. which found that the NO2 rose with the use of gas obs and increased in line with the amount of time it was used or for the number of rings in use on London's busy Marylebone Road, which recorded an average PM 2.5 level of 14, while in three kitchen volunteers who tested for PM 2.5, there were peaks of over 100 on several occasions.
Oh, blimey.
So that stuff that you learn at granny's knee sometimes gets challenged, I guess.
Yes.
an interesting thing. But on the upside, for a show that loves the bumblebees, they're saying that the weather last year fueled the decline in bumblebee population, but a comeback could be on. The number of bumblebees in 2024 was nearly a quarter down on the average figures for the period between 2010 and 2013, and was the worst on record, according to the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. But they're saying that the crucial pollinators, and they're called a keystone species for their crucial role in the life cycles of a huge range of flowers, plants, including fruit, vegetables, as well as crops for livestock like rapeseed oil. So the poor figures for bees in 2024 are maybe not quite as alarming as they sound. The numbers of insects often fluctuate dramatically from one year to the next due to the weather. And that's been said by an entomologist, Dr. Kelly Jowett, at Rotherstead Research, an agricultural research institute in Harpenden.
Ah, interesting. So, I've seen quite a few bees around our garden, and I think the bumblebees, because they're quite big.
Yes, I think it's picking up. So, say, it's that sort of swing that's been attracting my attention, I think, this time around, of different things. So news that the UK has entered a new solar power era, and they're saying that the UK has now had nearly 3,500 solar farms granted in the planning system. So the cost of panels has fallen sharply, and rapid increases in the efficiency with which they convert sunlight to power mean it's now the cheapest way to produce electricity in the UK. Well, pass it on, please.
Yeah. Oh, indeed.
Yeah. So the UK is also investing a substantial chunk of money into putting solar panels on NHS buildings and schools to help them with the pressure of the costs of energy. So the UK forecast is to build 50% of its solar power generation capacity this year. 50% more capacity this year than in 2024, which in turn was a 20% rise on the year before. That's from the Solar Media Market Research. So we're doing that. In a total, they say the 2,832 solar farms have been approved and are awaiting construction, with 637 awaiting a decision.
Wow. Are they spread evenly? Does it say whether they're spread evenly around the country, or is it concentrated in certain areas?
No, I'm sort of seeing a map for that. I'll go and have a dig round and see. But it's surprising, I think, sometimes that the distribution of these things can be affected by planning. So I think with the changes the government's trying to make to planning consents, then maybe we'll see a bit of a difference. It tends to be that rural and agricultural areas put up more of a complaint about the installation of solar farms. And I think, you know, it's the NIMBY attitude again. You know, we want the cheaper power, but we don't want to have the ugly things in our yard. Put them in somebody else's and just send us the power.
Yeah, I'm sure I saw something the other week about painting wind turbines a different colour because of the birds hitting them.
Yeah, well, yes, I think there is a thing to make them more visible for the birds, because it's taking quite a toll now on the bird population. So also in the news is a proposal to build towers for seabirds on alongside buildings, because they're tending now to try and nest in the taller buildings in towns and
yes, by the indeed, sea. Yeah.
So it's I'll say just a weird old mix this time, and something that I often think about. I was watching a show the other day which showed a chap with dementia, and took his tablets, went to go to bed, stopped and had a thought, went back and took his tablets again.
Yes, it's so, not good, is it?
No, well, this is the NHS is trying to promote a scheme that backs de-prescribing medicines. So to actually investigate people's medicines. And it's something I had a long-term thing with a nasal polyp. And I was given a spray and told to use it. And every time I go back in, I go, do I still have to use this? Yeah, keep on doing it. So it's something where it can happen. I know that they're doing it as a cost exercise through the NHS to either investigate alternative manufacturers, because some of the manufacturers are very expensive, so they're looking for like-for-like drugs to switch. But also they're saying, look, if you're getting your prescription and you don't need the drugs, don't do it.
Yeah.
I think there is a thing. Some of the things that you take your medication for vary with the time of year, temperatures and things like that, as to whether you need asthma inhalers and things like that. It'll come with pollen counts. So this is really to try and address what they think is just the sort of quick scribble to give you a follow-on prescription without really sort of calling you in for a check. So hopefully that's something that can be, and they're saying that obviously for people with things like dementia, it can be a real problem to control it. And I know sort of from personal experience with sort of family members and things, these dated or numbered compartments with your medication in, and I think a lot of the pharmacies now do an online service where instead of giving you a pot with 50 pills in it, they'll give you those 50 pills split into your daily dose into one of these compartmentalized containers.
Yeah, it's like a little tray, isn't it?
That's it. So yeah, sort of thing that you use in stuff like needlework and knitting for small sort of beads or whatever, but it's the same thing, those little small compartments of your daily dose, and you can put in a mixture of tablets if you are on a mix of tablets, but you know you've got the visible calendar in front of you to give you a bit of a reminder about whether you've taken your tablets or not. So I'd be interested to see how that one comes out. I think, what else have I been? Oh, yeah, so a baby with a rare thing. So this is, I'll put my teeth back and get to this one. But it's a baby boy with a rare illness is making incredible progress after he became the first patient to receive a new gene therapy. It's a 14-month-old boy called Thomas, and he was diagnosed with ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency,
blimey.
OTC, which is a lot better for me to say, when he was just a few weeks old. There are only 15 people a year are being diagnosed with this genetic condition, and it means that ammonia, a waste product that's generated by the body, breaks down in proteins and builds up in the blood. So even slightly elevated levels of ammonia in the blood can be toxic. So it's usually removed from the body in urine. And Thomas began to show extreme tiredness, inability to feed, and vomiting shortly after birth. But he was enrolled onto this groundbreaking OTC called the Hope Trial at Government Street Hospital, in which the gene therapy is delivered via an infusion to reach the patient's liver cells. So it's been designed to restore the damaged OTC gene with a functioning copy. And it's a kind of a similar thing that they're trying to do in a lot of areas to mend defective genes by this kind of a therapy. So they're trying it with a lot of joints, cartilage areas and things. So I think we talked briefly a couple of weeks ago about nasal cartilage being used to repair damaged joints. But this is actually at a bit more fundamental level than that. So that's an interesting sort of look. And, well, I think like a lot of us, there's news that birds can get road rage around traffic noise.
Oh.
So birds develop road rage due to traffic noise, as is shown. Researchers found that native species in the Galapagos Islands were changing their behaviour as a result of cars and lorries. Those frequently exposed to vehicles showed heightened levels of aggression, say scientists. So the study was published in the journal Animal Behaviour and examining the impact of the vehicle noise pollution on Galapagos yellow warblers, a songbird in the archipelago. And during the trials with traffic noise, the team found the warblers living in roadside territory showed increased aggression, but those living away from the noise showed decreased aggression relative to trials without noise.
Very interesting. I wonder if they think the noise is a threat to their, you know, like it's another bird or another species.
Yeah, well, the author, or one of the co-authors, Dr. Kagla Ake of Anglia Ruskin University, said birds use song during territorial defence.
Yes, they do.
And as an aggressive signal. However, if the external noise, like the traffic, interferes with that signalling, it effectively blocks this communication channel, and so they get increasingly
noisier. Aggression. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
brilliant.
Yeah, so I think it's that kind of a week. Well, just pass on one final one. Those wonderful cuddly guide dogs that are provided to a lot of blind people but are often in short supply, and they've developed a robot dog designed to assist the blind and visually impaired people, as well as provide guided tours of museums, and it's been hailed as a game changer by its developers. Robbie the Robo Guide has been developed by researchers at the University of Glasgow, who hope to provide life-changing experiences in indoor environments like museums and supermarkets. So not only can you stop and pick up your trolley, you can pick up your guide dog at the door.
Wow.
If they manage it. They say they cost about £8,000, and a large language model similar to ChatGPT can conduct an online search before speaking through speakers. An autonomous robot has also been fitted with a camera. So
it's
good,
just
news for our friends who are sight impaired or blind.
Science is amazing, isn't it? As you've just shown, and we're going to play you out, Paul, with a track from Procol Harum, Your Own Choice.
Thank you, Paul.
What can we say?
Oh, what a good pick.
I know. Bye-bye. Speak to you bye-bye. Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye. Bye.
Look forward. Cheers. Bye.
There's too many women and not enough wine. Too many poets and not enough rhyme. Too many glasses and not enough time. Draw your own conclusions. Draw your own conclusions.
What a great track. We played some cracking stuff today.
Brilliant, that.
That's Space... No, it's not. It's what? Your Own Choice by Procol Harum.
I remember it well.
Don't make them like that anymore. If you've just tuned in, of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday, 11 until 12. We should have Phil Muffett on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball, a fireball. Every time I gazed into your starry eyes, we'd take the path to Jupiter and maybe very soon.
Oh, good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. You're sounding loud and clear, even though you're on location.
I'm on location at Manvers.
It's exciting stuff. What have you been doing this morning then?
Well, I've done my first 10K run for a long time.
Oh, you slacker.
Couch 5K finished last week, so this week I decided I needed to do a longer run, and believe me, it was hard.
Oh, so you're not back to tip-top condition yet then?
No, well, I've kind of detrained myself to run shorter runs.
Oh.
So I've been able to do shorter, faster runs, but then you kind of sacrifice your distance and speed doing that, so I've got to now try and build my distance back up. So I did 10K this morning, and I was struggling at the end.
Oh,
really struggling.
It can only get better.
Yeah, yeah. They keep telling us you shouldn't do speed and distance. You need to do speed, or you need to do distance, but not both at the same time. Otherwise, something breaks.
Something like you. interesting. What? Just before we start, what's happened to your couch to 5K? Have they completed
their
training? Have they all passed?
The past. Yes, there's been some down this morning, been round and done
amazing.
The 5K loop.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I'd just like to I've been running with Sally Connolly and Nicola Ellis this morning and a few others, and we've like done a 10K run this morning. It's been hard, but it's been good.
Well, congratulations to it all, yeah. Particularly those who have just started it, because it's a life-changing thing to get fit.
It's a life-changing experience, and it does make you healthier. It does make you lighter. It makes you quicker, more alert, and you've got more energy. Once you've recovered,
yeah,
you've got
you feel
more
better,
energy to do
recover
things.
Quickly. So a big shout out then. Go on.
Yeah, yeah, and you've got some great friends as well.
You have, and that's really, really important. So
it's a really good support system. The other thing is, I've been listening to some this morning, and there was a guy really, really struggling, and he thought he was failing in running. What he's been doing is, he's been doing it on his own, and because he's done it on his own, he's been doing some walking, and it's like, well, actually, you are allowed to walk if you run out of energy or your heart rate's too high or you're out of energy. You know. So anyway, we've kind of got him under control, and he's kind of picked up, and he's a lot happier because he now realises he's doing okay.
Yeah, it's very odd when you're on your own, isn't it?
It is.
Brilliant. So, but a shout out there to Manvers Waterfront Boat Club.
Yes, and it's a lovely sunny morning.
I'll be
out on the dragon boat.
Ooh, are you fully trained up now?
Well,
I thought you were going to be
Royal Yachting Association powerboat course, so I'm part of the safety team.
Oh,
now.
Get you, blimey! Got your certificate as well. Excellent. So, for people who don't know who you are a member of Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
That's right.
Gone from strength to strength, I reckon, since COVID changed it all
it
for
has.
You.
Yes, the Zoom meetings are online now, and we're getting some. We've had some really good lecturers from all over the world. And they do some really good talks. We get about 45 minutes to an hour. And it's really nice to speak to people who are on the cutting edge of science.
Cutting edge, exactly.
And we hear things, the nuts and bolts astronomy that people are doing that you don't really hear about in magazines, and the stuff you don't see on TV, and you can ask them questions at the end. And it's a really good way of passing on that knowledge down to us amateurs.
Yeah, and then you pass it on to us. Yeah. So, coming up is an eclipse, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Now I've got a bit of a dilemma. Next Saturday, 10 while 12, there's an eclipse. So, it's right usually in the time when I'm down here. So
oh.
I don't know what I'm going to do.
Can't you combine the two? Can't you
well,
do it?
I'm thinking, should I bring my telescope down here and set it up and show people what's happening.
You could do that. Why don't you? Why don't you get mixed with Swinton Astronomical Society down to Manvers?
I might do that. We've got a nice patio. If I can set me gear up right on the patio, I might be able to set my computer up so we can see it on a TV monitor.
Oh, that's a challenge. What's the forecast, though, for next week?
Well, this is it. Everything that's really, really good in the sky is always cloudy. I've just ordered a solar filter for the telescope, and I'm hoping it's going to be here before Saturday. If so, I'll be able to fit my camera onto the telescope and project it.
So, are you talking about taking your own telescope down to Manvers then?
Yes,
because you can set that up in your garden. I know some people set theirs up almost permanently, don't they, in some sort of thing. But so you're transporting it then. Is that an easy thing then, to transport it?
Well, it's a bit heavy and clunky, but I can take it to pieces and put it back together again. When I set it up on the patio, I basically got to dismantle it and then set it up back again. It takes me about 5 to 10 minutes. So I've had a lot of practice at it now.
So if you do it at Manvers, you might have a whole raft of people suddenly interested in observing the eclipse.
Well, with the camper van I've got, I can get the tripod in the van in one piece and just take the telescope and the weights off so I can break my stuff down. So it's not a big job to put it back together again.
Brilliant.
One thing I would say is looking at the sun's really, really dangerous. So we have specialist equipment to do that. I've just sent off for a new solar filter for the telescope I've got. I'm hoping it's going to be here. If it is, I can put a camera on my telescope so that it's safe. So we use Bada filter and Mylar filters, which cut out 99% of the sunshine. So you don't basically cut your eyeballs or burn them.
It's not to be recommended, is it?
Yeah.
Do it carefully.
Look for optics at the sun. So it's really, really dangerous.
Are we expecting a full eclipse then next Saturday?
It's about 50%, which is really good. It should be noticeable. Now, if it's cloudy and you can just see the sun through the clouds, you will be able to notice the sun is being eclipsed. It starts about 10 o'clock from our location in South Yorkshire. Maximum is about 11 o'clock. And then it moves off at 12. So we've got basically an eclipse for about 2 hours, and it peaks at about 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. So, So I've also got some glasses with some Mylar film in, so I can look at the sun.
Some what film?
Mylar film. It looks like tin foil, but it lets a little bit of light through without actually harming your eyes.
So for anybody listening, don't use kitchen foil from your kitchen.
No. If you go online, you can order these like cardboard glasses with this film in them, or you can buy solar filters that you can fit on telescopes, but you make sure you get it from a reputable website or go to Rother Valley Optics down in Wales or basically offline or a telescope shop. You can buy filters to put at the front of your telescope, not at the back end of your telescope. Because basically the sun is very powerful and it melts things, and it burns things, and it fries things.
Yeah, well, indeed. So if we don't see anything next weekend, you're thinking, or your club generally does things at the RSPB Old Moor.
Yeah, we're planning some solar Sundays at RSPB at Old Moor. So they'll be on our webpage so you can see what days they are. Or RSPB.
Advertise them as well, don't they?
Yeah, they do them as well. So we'll have a group of guys down there, probably about six people with six telescopes. They've all got different types of filters and solar monitors so you can see the sun in different wavelengths. So there's different ways you can look at the sun with different filters, and it looks different in all these different filters. There's like calcium, magnesium, and then you can see H-alpha.
Is that because of the colours? It brings out different colours.
Yeah, that's right. So you can see different parts of the sun using different filters. So the H-alpha filter, you can see the flames on the sun, which are really, really good. And then the calcium filters are basically, it's like a purpley grey colour, and you can see the faculae and you can see ripples on the surface. The one I'm getting is just grey scale, so it'll just look like black and white, but it shows up the sunspots really good.
So you've got different people who've got different telescopes in your club basically. Because it's a great way to be able to use equipment that, that probably is rather expensive and not many people's going to have it, are they?
So, right, so the Barda film lens I'm getting's about £70. Now, if you use a H-alpha telescope, they're about £5,000. So there's a vast difference between the filters you use to look at the sun. So you can see if you're spending £5,000 on a filter to look at the sun in H-alpha, it's a serious piece of equipment, and obviously there's a safety factor and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What have you? What equipment have you got up at your observatory at Hoobastan then?
You know, so we've got a filter that fits on the front. We've got a H-alpha telescope. We've got a Barda film, and we've also got calcium filters as well, so we can see the sun in a different way. Ranges.
So are you doing anything up there next week?
There will be somebody up there, so if somebody turns up, we will be able to show people the sun.
Wow.
But if it is cloudy,
it's a shit.
We'll not bother.
No.
You never can tell with the British weather.
No,
but
I know.
I'm really hoping it's going to be a little bit better than it is today.
I remember one of your RSPB ones got cancelled, I think it was early this year, actually, because it was just
this year's been got off to a bad start.
I know.
We had a couple of things cancelled because it has been bad. Although we have had a couple of really, really clear nights. This last week, we've had two really exceptional clear nights and been able to do some photography. Tom Wade in our club, he's got a 10-inch F4 Skywatcher. He's got set up since Christmas, and he's starting to take some absolute superb photos with his telescope. These guys are doing a couple of hours exposures.
And
you'd think they were on Mauna Kea or Gran Canaria with the telescope. Absolutely stunning photos.
Wow.
And it's a detail. You can see the detail's unbelievable. You can see dust lanes and star formation. And stuff.
But you do put those pictures up, or some pictures are shared on your Facebook page and your website. It's a great website as well.
Yes.
Check out msas.org.uk.
I'm also, one of the projects I'm doing is asteroids. I've not photographed any this year, but as they're all coming round, I'm trying to find some new asteroids this year. And the other thing I'm also following at the moment is the T Corona Borealis, which is a flare star in Corona Borealis. And this sun's a red giant and white dwarf system. And what happens is about every 80 years, it explodes as it's pulling material off its companion star. It kind of overheats and then explodes, and then it starts building up again. So it was supposed to, we expected it blowing up last year, but it hasn't. Anyway, it's just started to rise about 11:30 at night time over the neighbour's house. So I've just started to pick it up again. Anyway, it's not blown up yet, but it's hovering around.
And can anybody see this then?
Well, it's about magnitude 10, so you need. You can't see it in binoculars. It's a bit too faint for binoculars. But when it explodes, they reckon it'll be a naked eye star. So it'll look like a brand new star in the sky. But magnitude 10 is a little bit faint for binoculars. But I can pick it up on the camera phone. If I put my phone on my telescope and do about a 10-second exposure, I can actually see it. But I'm getting stars down to about 14th magnitude. With my camera phone from the back garden with all the light pollution.
Happened about your light pollution and the council?
It's still happening. It's getting some. I'm thinking of putting a hood over it. To be honest.
Well, the street light.
Yeah, to be honest, with the gear, so if I work round it and point in different direction, because we know where the stars are going to be, I can predict when I can see stuff. In the garden, but the problem is you need to know where the things are because it's difficult to see. So what I'm using is bright stars to find fainter objects, but sometimes the light shines down the tube as well, so I've got to be really picky where so it is restricting some of the stuff I can do.
Wow.
It's really annoying, the street
I thought you were writing to Rotherham Council and saying, come on, what you changed bulb for?
It's really difficult to contact the right people in the right department.
Don't you work there?
I know.
Working for councils, we know.
It's a sore point. It's a real sore point.
You know, we used to work for Sheffield City Council, so you can imagine that's even bigger than Rotherham.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So what's your interest in asteroids then?
Basically, it's fine, but because so planets are moving around the sky all the time, and as we know, we've had nine planets we've been able to see, and the couple, Mercury's just disappeared last week, Venus has disappeared last week, we've lost Neptune and Saturn, but we have still got Uranus, Jupiter and Mars.
Is that because we're coming into spring and the angle of the Earth?
They've moved around into the Sun, but we have still got Jupiter and Mars, which are really good to see at the moment. Now, the asteroids are moving round a bit faster and they're a bit closer, so it's like the smaller objects, harder to find, harder to see. So they are whizzing around the solar system. So it's something I've not done before. I think I got six asteroids last year. So I've started off with the bright ones, and as I'm getting more experienced, I'm going to try and pick off the work down and pick off some of the fainter ones. So all the ones I've been doing at the moment have been magnitude like 6 and 7. So as I'm getting a bit more experience, I'm going to start
try and find smaller ones.
Yeah, it's just
aren't
a bit of a project
clear
I've not done before.
Oh, a bit of a challenge
Ceres,
for the year.
Yeah, Ceres is about 900 kilometres in diameter, and you can make a disc out of that with a telescope I've got. And Vesta is an oblong shape. It's a bit like an egg, and I've actually been able to pick out the shape of it, which I didn't think you could do at the distance and the size. I think that's about 700 kilometres in diameter, and I've actually got a shape out of that. I didn't imagine you could actually do that with amateur equipment, but apparently you can. So it's a bit of a learning experience. Well, astronomy is a learning experience.
It's a continual
Yeah. You learn how to do something and move on to do something else. So I've been doing this work for like 50-odd years, and you never know it all.
No, interestingly, I'm glad you've said that, because
you never know it all.
Somebody in your club put some photographs up of very young looking you and some other members of your club, and I knew it was you straight away, and a lot of the people did. But how long ago was it when Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society was founded then?
1978, Ernie Richardson and Les Marsden. And his son, Glenn Marsden, is still in the
society. Oh, I see. I never knew they were father and son. Right.
Yeah. Glenn's still on the committee. Les is getting a little bit old now, and he's played a bit of a back role lead. But Les is still knocking
around. That's amazing. So, obviously, when you first started, you didn't have the observatory near Hoover, did you?
No, we didn't. We had his own little telescopes. And we used to meet up at the Working Men's Club and talk to each other about astronomy. And drink beer and crisps. and I joined in 82. I was a member for a couple of years, and I was doing an apprenticeship. And because we got nothing, I think we had about £28 in the bank.
Oh, dear.
Club membership. We were only paying like 50 pence a week to be a member. And I did an apprenticeship, and as part of my final exam, we had to make a small dome. And I said to college lecturer, if my mate helps me, can we make a bigger dome, like 2 metres in diameter, and I'll pay for the wood. So the lecturer says, well, it'll take a bit of doing. So I worked through dinner times and stuff at college, and me and my two, three mates built a 2 metre diameter wooden dome. I got my qualification and passed flying colours and everything. Got that back to the observatory.
Wow.
Back to the club. And then I built the base, which was square, in the back garden at home for the dome. And then what we did is I sold it to the club for the amount of money that it cost to build, which were £28.50. And then what we did is we basically shared it around people's gardens. So it was in Mark Benton's garden for a year. And then we moved it to somebody else's garden for a year. And so basically, we acquired an 8-inch fullscope reflector telescope with a motor drive, and we used the club scope, and we had an observatory. The observatory was that successful in people's back gardens that led us on to build the observatory up at Hoover,
amazing,
which is just basically a bigger version of what we started with in bricks and mortar and steel.
Very quickly, because we are running out of time, the film show is next. How did you fund building your observatory? Because it's quite a thing, isn't it?
We won Astromine competition back in the 1980s, which was a national astronomy magazine quiz, which we final, which was the final, was in London, and Patrick Moore was the question master.
Blimey.
We even beat Cambridge at their World Astronomy.
Yes.
Which was a coup. That I think we got £500 for that. But basically, we just borrowed and got donations, and a lot of people contributed things.
Amazing.
Like
and Yorkshire Water, did they donate
Yorkshire
the land?
Water, yeah, we rented it, but now we've bought it.
Yeah.
I think we paid £50 a year to rent it.
And look at you now. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's brilliant, isn't it?
Well, when they were selling land off Yorkshire Water, they were like, well, we need to buy our plot before somebody buys it from under our feet.
Yes.
So we bought it. I think it was about £1,000 in legal costs. And so now we own this plot. So,
wow.
Yeah,
amazing. Brilliant stuff, Phil. And we have to let you go. Enjoy your time on the water.
Lovely.
All right.
Remember,
take care.
Be safe looking at the sun.
Exactly. Bye bye, Phil. Bye. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Still.